Exchange Program at the Ragon Institute of MGH, Harvard, and MIT, and a professor at the Harvard THN School of Public Health. She leads a group that uses an array of new technologies to understand the biology of Mycobacterium tuberculosis, which is the bacterium that causes TB, tuberculosis. And this actually still remains the top cause of death from infectious diseases. And her work has specifically revolved around this key conundrum, which is the huge diversity in outcomes of TB disease and treatment between individuals, as around 90% of infected individuals actually develop latent infection that's essentially clinically silent, while others go on to progress to really severe chronic pathology. So do you want to start by introducing yourself, telling us about your research background and maybe what drew you to TB in particular?
Okay, I'm Sarah Fortune. I am the John Laporte Given, a professor of immunology and infectious diseases and the chair of the Department of Immunology and Infectious Diseases at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. And I have worked on tuberculosis my whole professional life. I am trained as an MD, as a medic, and I went to medical school in New York City at Columbia. I started in 1991, and as probably most people are aware, that was sort of the height of the HIV epidemic in New York City before the widespread rollout of antiretrovirals. And so in New York, what that meant was that there was both widespread HIV, but there was a TB epidemic in New York and Manhattan at that time. So the rates of TB in New York were equivalent to current rates in many high burden countries now. And so I was like many people, totally astonished that TB hadn't been eliminated, circa 1980. And I also felt like there was not any interest in TB, that everybody at that moment in time, everybody's interest was focused on HIV. And I mean, HIV was, really the pressing problem of the time, but there was basically so little work being done on the basic science of TB. And so I decided that I just thought the whole thing was fascinating and that I was going to work on TB. And then I went and worked at the Wellcome Trust clinical research unit in Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam for a year after medical school. And they did not have dedicated TB study, but basically everybody who came in, whether it was in the typhi study, in the malaria study, in the JE study, everybody who came in had some evidence of TB infection prior to late TB infection or sometimes overtly active TB. And it just gave you a sense of the incredibly incredible reach of this infection. And again, how few people were sort of paying attention to it.
Mm-hmm. And now that the research has developed, I guess we know all these fascinating aspects about TB biology. Hopefully, just in the interest of clarity, we'll channel the ones that your lab has been interested in. So you've had a particular interest in the diversity in mycobacterial populations and how this diversity and heterogeneity arises.
Yeah, actually, so one of the overarching question that I've always been really motivated by is why the outcomes of TB infection and actually TB treatment differ so much between individuals. And you can just see that in sort of the world numbers. So we often say that between a quarter and a third of the world's population is latently infected with TB, which means that most of those people are infected with TB. We think they, many of them still carry the infection. And most of those people are never gonna get sick from TB. And yet, 5 to 10% of those people get sick, and that makes TB, at least before SARS-CoV-2, the deadliest infectious disease in the world, right? And so, it's that spread in outcomes. Actually, you can see that spread in outcomes with SARS-CoV-2 as well, and I think it's probably reflective of many infectious diseases. And so I have always been interested in that. And so part of my work is trying to understand bacterial determinants. And then part of my work has been trying to understand host site determinants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if we maybe start with the host determinants, you'd maybe think that because TB is such a chronic disease and caused by widespread chronic inflammation, this diversity would only rise at the systemic level, but you've actually shown that even at single cell level, when you infect single macrophages, there's a differential response to MTB, so the bacterium. How do you explain that? And maybe how extensive are these differences?
Well, so I always, I'm what I would call a qualitatively quantitative person. But as a qualitatively quantitative person, I've been always impressed by the importance of bottlenecks in small numbers. And so TB is an infection whose outcome really is dictated by what happens in the scale of a very small number of infection events. So we think people are infected with, you know, 1, 2, 3 bacteria, right? That's like tiny. And they set up all these very geographically diverse sites of infection. So it's not like a, you know, the common model of an infectious disease where you have a bag of person and it's all just sloshing around in there, you know, they're very discrete sites. And yes, some of those sites of infection, and indeed if it's at the level of the single infected cells, some of them do well and some of them do badly. And I have always found that incredibly compelling. And you can imagine different reasons for that. I don't think we know what the reasons are. And I suspect it is a combination of a program diversity on both the host side and the bacterial side that when they intersect sort of sets up stable pathways, some of which favor the bacterium and some of which favor the host. And that it's that stability in that you kind of sit at the apex of a teeter-totter where you can easily tip one way or the other and maybe more easily tip into control that probably is an important determinant of what you see at the population level. You know, most people are going towards control, but occasionally people tip into disease.
Mm-hmm. So this variability in response, do you see it as something that's stochastic or that's orchestrated in a way?
Okay, well, personally, I feel like stochastic is the label we give things we don't understand, right? And so I do believe in stochastic variation, but oftentimes I feel like people use the term stochastic when they're just sort of throwing up their hands and saying, like, it's stochastic, and therefore, and actually stochastic, that label of stochastic often comes with a sense of like the research is not worth doing, the question is not worth asking because it's stochastic, therefore there's no sort of mechanistic answer possible, and therefore there's no intervention possible. And I don't think I believe that a lot of the variation that we see is stochastic. I think there are pathways that we don't really understand. Yes, on both the bacterial side and the host side.
Yeah, I mean, I was gonna ask after, because this obviously there's noise in all biological systems, but maybe this we can explain it away as the resolution of our techniques progress. Maybe it was called stochastic 20 years ago. Now we have well-defined right. mechanism underlying it.
That's exactly right. And in fact, you can in the TB field, you can see that there's, for example, bacterial cell-to-cell heterogeneity. In all sorts of processes. And we, as you say, we used to call that stochastic because, you know, we didn't have any understanding of what that might be. And now we have a much better sense of mechanisms of transcriptional diversity where genetic diversity in expression systems intersects with things like bistable switches to create, you know, population level heterogeneity that plays out in how the bacterium responds to its environment.
Mm. And do you have any examples of those that are quite particular to MTB? So there is that, their method of division, their asymmetric division, for example.
Right.
Is this quite unusual for bacteria to generate diversity in that way, or?
Okay, so what you're referring to is the fact that TB is rod shaped, so it's shaped like a lozenge, and many rod shaped bacteria sort of elongate through by laying down new cell wall material all along the barrel of the cell wall. And TB doesn't do that. So TB elongates by laying down new cell wall material at its tips, at its poles. But not only that, it actually lays down, it remembers which pole had previously been a division plane and which pole had previously been a growing tip. And the growing tip grows faster than the division plane and the previous division plane. And so what that means is the bacterium lays down new cell wall asymmetrically, and so one and then divides in the middle, and so one daughter cell inherits older or older content than the other daughter cell. And that if that makes sense. And then in fact, we are now that our microscopy techniques are better, we are increasingly able to see the consequences of that diversity in growth apparatuses and cell wall composition in those two cells. The most obvious of which is something like permeability, and why, how like resistant the cell wall is to stuff getting in, and why would you care about that? You'd care about that because actually it is a major fundamental determinant of a bacterium's susceptibility to drug. So if you're less permeable, you're sort of intrinsically more resistant to drug than if you're more permeable. And that sort of basic drug susceptibility divides by the age of the daughter cell.
Okay, yeah. And then moving on to maybe to some of your more recent work. This is the paper through which I discovered your work. So it's one of, well, now recent, I'd say 2 years now, collaboration with other groups at Harvard, MIT, and the Broad Institute. And so maybe to distill the approach to its core for listeners, what you have is a system where you're infecting macrophages with BCG, so essentially an experimental model of MTB. And you inactivate a huge panel of genes individually and see which ones are the determinants of response and which ones lead to improved, which ones, when knocked down, improve to better response to TB. Maybe can you just talk about the technological implementation of that? So how you do the gene inactivations and how you do the barcode system with a guide RNAs to map that.
So that work was done by Yong Lai, who was a postdoc in Tim Liu's lab, actually. And then he came and did the sort of the final stages of that in sitting up in Boston at a core facility that we share that allows sort of collaborative work on TB. And the beauty of a CRISPR screen in general is that it's actually very easy to genetically track the fate of every member of a population because the sort of identity of the cell is encoded in the CRISPR guide RNA. And so he had created a very beautiful library of both inducible knockdowns and inducible overexpression strains that then allowed him to try to parse pathways by which were important for macrophages to control TB infection. And actually, and as you say, he worked with BCG in the beginning, but then actually was very nicely able with a student in my lab to show that what he had found in macrophages with BCG translated to TB.
Yeah, so I mean, maybe I could d direct the listeners to the paper, but the experimental setup is that at the end, by virtue of cells resisting better, you enrich for the ones that have enhanced survival, and you can map it down to the genes. Can you maybe talk about some of those hits you found? So the enriched genes, and were they more of a surprise, or did they go more alongside with the previously published literature?
Some of them were surprised. Some of them went with the previously published literature, as you'd hope. You know, he found I think the nicest part of that work was actually being able to move from the genes to small molecules that targeted the same pathways, like the aryl hydrocarbon receptor, because obviously that's what you want to do. You want to find targets, and you'd love to find targets that improve macrophage ability to control TB, right? So it's kind of easy to go the other direction, to find targets that worsen control, right? Because it's easy to screw things up. It's hard to make things better. And so the nice thing about that was, you know, he found targets that were able to make things better, to improve control, and then move from that to small molecules that had potentially the potential to work as therapeutics for host-directed therapy.
Right. So you see the main, because obviously once you generated this data set, you want to exploit it. And so you see it as generating targets to screen small molecule inhibitors and drugs. The main interest in having those hits?
Maybe not screen small molecule inhibitors or drugs, but focus small molecule inhibitor and drug studies, a way to think about that. You know, the complexity, so in the field, it would be very nice to take what is a pretty good immune response, right? Most people do well, you know, as we started to say, most sites of infection do well. So in most people, the immune response is pretty good. And what you'd love to do is tip it into great, like, you know, and so you just want to move it slightly for pretty good to great. And so it's very attractive to think about targeting inflammatory responses as part of an effort to do that. That's called host-directed therapy. And, and you know, it's attractive because in part because you can't develop resistance, or there's not bacterial side resistance to host-directed therapy. So it like seems very super obvious, but it's very hard to know how to do that well. And so do you go from human cells to animals to humans, or fish to mice to monkeys, or, you know, like it's not so obvious how to do that. And so it is most compelling, I think, when the number of pathways are identified redundantly in different models. And then one can think about moving into the higher order systems in an effort to test those pathways and think about ideally a very short path to humans, which I think is where we really need to concentrate our efforts. So that would be the benefit of that, is like the aryl hydrocarbon receptors come out there. You know, maybe they come out of fish, and then you think, hey, this is great. Let's try to prioritize these pathways. That would be the ideal. Not that the aryl hydrocarbon receptors did come out of fish, but, you know, like something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true what you say about host-directed therapy seeming more, not intuitive, but at least they're not imposing these selective pressures to drive emergence of resistance like our current antibiotics do. And maybe TB fundamentally is an aberrant response of the host. So here we're kind of talking at a different level because we're talking about cell intrinsic modulation. But TB is the host having a maladaptive response to the persistent infection.
100%, yes. I would 100% agree with you. TB is the maladaptive response of the host. TB disease is the maladaptive response of the host.
So the thing with, for example, this CRISPR screen is that you're detecting pathways that modulate response just in macrophages. But it would be interesting if we could kind of scale this up and see the cell networks and the systemic response. Like if we could be doing, for example, these CRISPR screens in two cell types at the same time, because obviously any disease is like an emergent properties of cell networks in a way, that dysfunction. So
yeah, I totally agree with you. And it's, so in a sort of different arm of the lab, We've been working to use single cell transcriptional profiling to understand the cellular networks in monkey granuloma. And monkey granuloma have the advantage of looking pretty much like human granuloma and have the advantage of doing something that only humans and non-human primates do and sort of no other animal species does well, which is actually successfully control infection, you know, or not. So they sit at that in this teeter-totter space where most animals either sit on one side of the teeter-totter or the other side of the teeter-totter. And so we've been using single cell transcriptional profiling to establish the expression characteristics and then the sort of network models for control or loss of control in those cellular environments. And they're really complicated. And there are all sorts of cells that seem to play really big roles that we just would never have thought about, like mast cells. Mast cells are not in any TV model. And so I'm increasingly thinking that we're going to need to use those sort of profiling approaches to understand the complexity of disease in a, you know, in human tissue. And then use this the signaling nodes that emerge out of that to target those as maybe a more likely path to effective therapy. Mm-hmm. At least that's my thinking today.
Yeah, I mean, talking about underrated, the big one, it seems, antibodies, because it's almost the textbook definition that BCG is a vaccine which induces T cell, that protection right. is mediated by T cells. But you've also recently shown that the protective role of antibodies. So what do you think, that's also exciting because it opens all the tool set from humoral responses, let's yeah. say in HIV, for example, that we can reapply to TB. But can you maybe talk about, yeah, what you've recently discovered about the role of antibodies in TB?
Yeah, sure. As you say, antibodies have been really, really, really neglected. They were sort of the poor stepchild of the TB field. And then over the past, I guess, 7 years now, I've been working with Galit Alter at Mass General Hospital at the Reagan Institute, who developed a platform she calls System Serology, which allows the high throughput characterization of antibody reactivity. So like what the antibody sees, and then the tail of the antibody. So which is where the antibody carries all the information about what that antibody is trying to get the immune response to do. So that's called the FCN. And so long story short, what all that work has shown is that in TB, there are antibodies that are correlated with infection outcome. And in fact, you can use antibodies to, in small animal models anyway, skew infection outcome in both good and bad directions, depending both on what the antibody sees and on the characteristics of the tail of the antibody. So you're right. So for TB, the whole dogma had been, it's all about T cells. And now there's sort of this appreciation that you could use, especially the vaccine tools that are available to train, develop humoral responses in primarily against viral infections. However, I think it's important to recognize that in many viruses, we think about antibodies primarily serving a neutralizing function. You know, and that may be an overly simplistic model in the viral infections about how antibodies work, but the prevailing model is so antibodies block something, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that in TB, it is more likely that antibodies tune the immune response, and it's that FC and paired with the ability to see TB antigens that are drawing the right innate and adaptive cellular constituents to the site of infection, and then tuning the level of inflammation in those sites of infection. So I think it's a little bit different model. They're like the great rheostats on the sites of TB infection.
So for example, you think instead of direct neutralization, it would be like antibody-dependent cellular cytotoxicity or recruiting complement?
So I do think actually the recruitment of NK cells is probably important. The antigen specific recruitment of NK cells is an important element, and cytotoxicity in general is a completely underappreciated contributor to TB control. And then I think that the antibody ends that are less inflammatory, maybe the sort of the tuning of inflammation states, so you can have FCNs that are like screaming inflammation, and others that are more anti-inflammatory. I think that those more anti-inflammatory ends may be important in either limiting the extent of inflammation or inflammation resolution, which is sort of the probably a key to fixing that maladaptive part of the immune response to TB infection.
Mm-hmm. No, I was going to say, what do you think is the first direction we should go in now that we are seeing the importance of the antibodies more? Should they, for example, should we privilege those as diagnostics or prognostics? Or
I think we should be trying to understand whether we can mechanistically harness them. And so I think they do have diagnostic benefit. And actually, if we were more sophisticated in our ability to read out antibody reactivity and sort of the ends of the antibodies, actually, they might reflect, we might have a better understanding of disease state. Right now, you know, our understanding of TB disease state is like you're sick or you're latent. And, you know, there's probably like two axes there in terms of both extent of disease and then the kind of disease you have. And so I think antibodies could be used diagnostically to understand in that sort of care framework. But I think where they'd really be transformative is if we could, either through passive transfer studies or study vaccine approaches, try to understand whether we can vaccine and adjuvanting, use antibodies to kind of hit the sweet spot for the right characteristics of the immune response that would, you know, limit infection, but not be so inflammatory that, you know, people are going to skid off the end into like tissue damage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I guess that it links to the field. There's many controversies around those, but the observations that BCG vaccination leads to this non-specific reduction in mortality. And there's been quite a lot of all these ideas around trained immunity and so on. Now that you mentioned all these modulatory roles that the antibodies could have.
I actually think that antibodies, and when people talk about the trained immunity framework, you know, they're often talking about a world in which they're comparing myeloid compartment with T cell compartment, and they're kind of forgetting about the antibody compartment. And I think that actually, in terms of thinking about how the immune response maintains homeostasis in a certain set point, antibodies are actually an attractive way to think about how that occurs.
Okay. Usually the T cells are neglected and the antibodies are all the focus. So I guess that's one counter example. But
yeah, okay. In the viral world,
yeah, it's
T cells are neglected and the antibodies are all the focus. In the TB world, it's all about T cells and myeloid cells. And then the antibodies are like, they don't exist.
Right. I mean, one thing I was very impressed with reading your papers is all the mentioned high throughput. Essentially, you have really cutting edge technology. So for example, you're using microfluidics, which is kind of in this trend to miniaturize experiments and use label-free ways to visualize things. Obviously CRISPR, genetic constructs, Lumina sequencing, I mean, all of those. And do you think that the next advances in microbiology will be technology-driven?
I think yes. You know, for complex diseases like TB, where a lot of the disease is you know, at the level of the tissue, and there are a lot of interacting cell types that are sort of probably important in the infection outcome or treatment outcome. We have got to get more sophisticated about how we ask those questions, and especially, and the other part is, we have to get more sophisticated about how we ask questions in the highest value systems. And obviously humans are the highest value system. And then, you know, monkeys, so systems that really look like human disease, and understand that we should be using, and I'll just put it in air quotes here, systems level approaches to be able to understand disease in those contexts, even though it's messy and intervention, you know, mechanistic interventions are hard. That's probably where we're going to actually move the needle in terms of new treatments and new interventions.
Okay, so new techniques, but also asking sharper questions in our
new techniques applied to the gold standard systems. New techniques applied to humans. New techniques applied the integration of non-human primates. A limited use of non-human primates, but the integration of those, and then, you know, God knows, maybe, you know, organoids will finally emerge and we'll have multicellular organoids, you know, that really incorporate all these different cell types and stuff, and that we can use those as well. I'm actually a big fan of human challenge models. There's a really nice paper actually from Imperial recently about skin challenge, PPD skin challenges in people. But again, trying to get to people with different disease states, but getting to this sense of the ability to ask questions in humans and understanding the complexity of the immune ecosystems that you will find.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the actual human challenge models where we actually administer the whole pathogen, I think yellow fever virus, I'm not sure, but I mean, the set is very, very restricted. And of course, it's not.
Not as restricted as you might think. Malaria, you know, typhi, flu, SARS-CoV-2, like it's pretty, so I don't think that we will, I think it'll be a while before we get to a pathogenic TB pulmonary challenge. But I do imagine that there are ways to do a pathogenic TB skin challenge and safely. And then, as you know, Helen McShane is also doing BCG skin challenges and BCG pulmonary challenges.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's almost like for some of these pathogens, well, I suppose the prevalence of TB is a bit lower, but for example, like EBV and CMV, you're pretty much bound to get them, so you might as well get them in the right conditions.
Yeah, well, I don't think you can give somebody the pathogen without the expectation that you're going to be able to cure them.
Of course.
I don't think you can give them EBV, like wild type EBV or CMV. I don't think you can do that. But I think we've been building TB suicide strains so that you could basically the bacterium is addicted to some exogenous small molecule, let's say caffeine. So if you take caffeine or doxycycline or something like that, and if you take doxycycline, it lives. And then once you stop taking doxycycline, it just like, it commits suicide, you know, something like that. So that you're not really giving somebody TB that you expect them to have, or to expect them to have to take a full course of antibiotics for, but you're trying to better recreate the dynamics of a pathogenic infection.
Mm-hmm. I think it was around maybe 10 years ago now that the WHO, I mean, they formulated the goal of ending the TB pandemic by 2030. And my question is, what do you think is the role of fundamental research in that? Like, do we really need a completely different class of therapeutics, new, for example, like, you know, genomic surveillance technologies? Do we really, yeah, what's the role of fundamental research versus implementing what we already have and what I call the more clinical and public health side?
Yeah. A couple, I'm going to give you three things to answer your question. First, I just want to point out that while we were making some progress towards those goals until SARS-CoV-2, we now have started going the wrong direction. And so it is very clear we're not going to come anywhere close to meeting those goals. The WHO estimated that if we just use the tools we had better, that we wouldn't eliminate TB by 2030, but we could eliminate TB maybe in like 70 or 100 years. I can't remember exactly what the timeline was, but it was very slow, but still possible. And I think that's important. I think that one should not think that TB, we shouldn't be using the tools we have better. And it's specifically, actually, I think SARS-CoV-2 has taught us a lot about testing, like really aggressive testing. If we could, you know, like in my university, we test everybody. Now we're testing everybody once a week. The undergrads get tested twice a week. Like if you could roll out that kind of testing for TB, that would be transformative. But obviously to do that or to vaccinate, which would be the other transformative advance, or to significantly shorten treatment, which may not be transformative in terms of limiting the epidemic, but it would certainly be transformative in the ease with which that the health system can deal with the TB epidemic. All of those things are going to need basic science discoveries to move those forward.
Mm-hmm. And maybe to finish off, is there one in particular, maybe one advance in microbiology or immunology that really excites you personally? And then you bring the field forward.
Yeah, I have to say, I was never a believer that, I was kind of a TB vaccine nihilist, if I'm honest, until relatively recently. But now I'm actually really excited because I feel like there is an increasing sense of what immune responses and what flavors of immune responses could be protective. And it's not just sort of general, more T cells are better. And at the same time, a better sense of using modern tools, both adjuvants and delivery platforms, that we could, in fact, very finely tailor the characteristics of a TB vaccine response. So I am actually pretty optimistic about next-gen TB vaccines.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's true because the vaccine research has amped up so much in the last 2 years. Obviously, hopefully some of this will spill over and be like pathogen independent.
That's right. 100% right. Well, and it is pathogen independent already because we know a lot more about the kinds of immune responses that are emerging in people. And we know a lot more about, and we can pair those with the responses that we want to get out of a TB vaccine. And so, even though it was on a different pathogen, it does accelerate our research as well.
Great. Well, thank you so much. If you would redirect, say, young scientists interested in TB, obviously they can find your page online. Do you have any, papers, groups, or resources you direct them towards?
Yes. I would suggest that if you're just trying to understand the basics of TB and what needs to be done, that you check out the Stop TB Partnership, which is at stoptb.org, which gives you a really good sense of both the scale of the problem and potential for new solutions.
Okay. Right. Well, I think hopefully our conversation it does show that there's hope in the field. Science can achieve great things. So thank you so much for your time.
It is a pleasure.